Wapping project is a vision which encapsulates new work, the commissioning of writers, poets, choreographers, composers, filmmakers, video makers and photographers.
Hello and welcome to Pass Forward, the Wapping Project at 20. This is the new podcast series from the Wapping Project. My name is Gareth Evans. I'm your host for this and all episodes in this 20-episode exploration of the Wapping Project in all its incarnations as a commissioning body, as an advocate for women's work, and as an international cultural organisation, thinking through what culture can be both personally and socially at a challenging time in the world as we find it. I'm delighted this week to welcome my guests Sophie Hughes and Jane Kalecka. Welcome to you both.
Hello.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much indeed for being with us. You're acclaimed translators, writers and activists in the world of language, and it's a great pleasure to have you on the Wapping Project at 20 to think through really what translation means in the times we find ourselves in, but also what it means to be working as women in translation, both as activists for the language, as I mentioned, but also at a time when women's writing is, of course, exploding into the space it should always have occupied, particularly coming into English, but also where we're thinking through what women as translators are doing much more carefully and sensitively than perhaps previously we were. And so it's a real delight to be in conversation with you both, acclaimed in your respective languages, translating Sophie from Spanish into English primarily and Jen from German into English. And you both published pieces in Resonance, the Wapping Project's current in-house magazine. And I'd like to think through those pieces to these larger issues, if I may. So perhaps we could start with you, Jen. Now, you were engaging with Elena Brotheris's photographic work and her larger sense of scoring in your piece for the publication Resonance. And I'd like you, if you don't mind, just to give us a sense of what you mean by her idea of scoring and how you kind of took that forward into the idea of translation.
I think in my piece, I was really going to town on this idea of basically anything being ripe for translation. So in the case of Elena Brotheris's project, it was looking at how she had primarily been using these scores, which had been created by a number of artists over the years, which then she translated into her own interpretation of these scores. So these scores are kind of artistic prompts that can be picked up by any artist in any period of time, in any place around the world, and turned into something that's their own. And I'd previously been interested in the idea of visual art and translation when I was doing my master's thesis many years ago, where I was looking at how the paintings of photographs by Gerhard Richter, he had like a big retrospective at Tate Modern at the time I was doing my master's, how these to me also felt like translation. So you had an unmistakable image, you had a kind of source text, as it were, that was being engaged with, but that by him painting photographs, you could visibly see his process of translation through the particular mark making he made or the paint that he used. So again, with the brother of scores, you can see a distinct playfulness. She, in her kind of collaboration with a performance artist, makes these really joyful photos that take place in her home or in nature that are very whimsical and have a particular flavour that is hers. So yeah, looking at how any kind of interpretation process is a form of translation and how fundamental the person doing that process is in that making.
Well, that's tremendous. I mean, I'm really glad that we've already kind of exploded the idea of translation as being, in terms of the literary context, just a move from page to page, and obviously translated it now, to borrow a phrase, into a medium exchange. Now, Sophie, taking that forward to your own work with Wapping and your translation of Alia Trabuco-Zoran's story for the publication of Resonance, I wonder if you find that idea of visualization useful in thinking about how you begin to translate a work, because of course you are working, as I said, from page to page in this case, bringing a story from Spanish into English. But does a visualization help you kind of render it into this new language that, that you're undertaking?
It does, as much as it does any reader. I suppose another thing that Jen's piece in Resonance, which I really, really enjoyed and got a lot out of, was talking about how translation is really more than just kind of deciphering. It's also the resonance can only happen if there's a kind of sense and passing on of the meaningfulness of the text or the piece of work that you are reinterpreting or interpreting. Yeah, we talk about stories being particularly vivid to us, which I suppose is another way of saying that they really speak to us. Visualising certain practical things with translation is quite funny sometimes. I, for example, find one of the most difficult things to do in translation is to translate, for example, a description of a house or a plot of land, which is really interesting because these are almost the kind of given facts that the author has provided us with. There's really you would think to interpret, but actually it's really difficult to kind of throw your mind's eye into that space and to make sure that you are describing it as clearly as you can travel through that space in English. I've always found that really interesting to me, how often the kind of ambiguities or the perhaps more like emotional kind of responses that one gets as a reader are easier to translate in a way. Perhaps because you know that you are the only reader who will necessarily be reading it like that, and there's nothing you can do about that as a translator, so the sooner you accept it, the more confidence you will have to just be able to render it your way and say, well, look, I am the given, chosen translator for this piece, so it may not be how someone else would have read it, but I'm the one doing it.
No, that's tremendous. I mean, thank you very much indeed for picking up on those other aspects of Jen's piece. I mean, Jen, taking those ideas forward, I mean, given that we're speaking under the sort of umbrella of the idea of resonance, Sophie's point, of course, about, you know, some of the most basic elements of a culture, a house, what is meant by a woodland or a playground or a city park, being the real challenge to translate into another language where those resonances, of course, have different implication and meaning and weight to the recipient culture. Would you take that forward and sort of think about the idea of the translation of ideas? Because it means literally to bear across, of course, and to kind of carry across from the Latin. But as one carries anything across, things have to be let go. You know, there is a change in the emphasis, as Sophie so clearly described. And so, with resonance and storytelling being another central part of your essay, where do you put the weight of the impulse to translate?
Well, I think, yeah, firstly, I was kind of nodding furiously to everything Sophie was saying, and it also means a lot to me that she enjoyed the piece. I think, yeah, going back very strongly to what Sophie is saying about this idea of embracing the fact that you are a human consciousness that is reading this text, and perhaps the only way that you can, and again coming to terms with the fact that you in yourself, you know, not suppressing the fact that you're an individual and that you will read something very particularly, again, like that is such a key part of translation. And I think it's funny because not everyone feels that way necessarily as translators, you know, this idea that it's somehow really icky to be like, well, you know, it's me that's doing this writing and you know that I'm here, being the mediator of this text. What she was saying about space, I completely agree. I was having this conversation just the other day when I was doing a workshop, that so much of translating space goes through a visualization, you know, like if you're saying, oh, this is beyond this or this is in the distance, I'm always thinking like, but what does that mean in the mind's eye? What is the reader seeing? And, you know, what are steps in a Japanese novel in a public park versus what's in this context, etc. So I completely agree with that. In terms of the discussion of weight in translation, I think obviously it's become a real kind of cliche around what gets lost in translation. It's become this kind of obsession in discourse around, you know, what is being lost in translation. And one way of looking at it is whatever is lost in a way maybe isn't integral, and you know, everything that can be carried across will be carried across, but things like, you know, the loss or the altering of the weighting of even a sentence or in a paragraph or a novel, it's not necessarily being lost, it's being transformed and appearing in different ways. And again, I really it's a very visual process for me. You know, if I'm translating a sentence and I can see in my mind's eye what the key gem in that sentence is in the German, but it's not able to be directly replicated in English, you know, I'm holding on to that little spark that's in that sentence and I'm placing it or reconfiguring it in a different way. So you're not losing anything, it's just that the spark is appearing in another way that I've had to kind of recreate. And yeah, as we know, it's really difficult to try and talk about translation, and we always revert to metaphors, which again I think speaks to the visualness of this practice, that that metaphors are endlessly being created to describe it, because it's having to translate experience into a third thing in order to explain what's going on.
In the same way as that, you know, for example, you could read a passage of a book and know that you had heard the you feel very deeply that you'd heard the significance, or some kind of deep, profound significance had been brought across to you. So as again, it's a carrying across from author to reader. But that could describe the perhaps the charisma of the author, or the poetry of the author, or whatever it is that's really touched you. How impossible is that to convey to someone that you're sitting next to you as you read it and you finish a passage and you want to look to them and say, you can't understand what I just read, or what it means to me, or how beautiful it is, or how it's touched me. And I think that often that feeling is translated into the process of translation as the kind of slow deliberateness of it. So it's that kind of thinking, okay, what is it? It's an unpicking of what they've done linguistically to bring that across. And it's a kind of slow, deliberate thinking and reading through a text.
Now that's extremely interesting, because of course, you know, the idea of translation, as you say, already exists within the kind of the agreement, the unspoken agreement between writer and reader, their translation into the reader's mind, as you well described. And so we already can see a kind of a politics of translation unfolding, can't we? I mean, primarily, I guess, the idea that things can't be translated, as you said, Jen, or, you know, that too much is lost, being an idea already about a raising of kind of border walls and fences against this kind of communication across languages, which is, of course, the last thing we need at the moment. But in terms of how those pairings come about, I'm curious to know in both your cases, where you've sought books out yourself to offer for translation into English, or where you've been paired by the publisher with, you know, a book in the respective language, because they feel that you're either as a personality suited to the work in question, or that your previous linguistic activity has shown a preference for that way of thinking in the original language. Could you each give us a sense of how those relationships emerge?
I began translating after a very short, well, a kind of 3-year stint on the other side of the industry, of publishing industry, as a literary agent. I was an assistant to a literary agent. So I sort of knew how to pitch books to publishers. I'd been watching it for 3 years. My career as a translator, with that confidence to be able to approach publishers. So I've also, you know, that paired with a lot of luck, I've often translated books that I chose and translated samples of and ended up working on. That does create a very pleasant working environment. You know, you absolutely set up your own environment for yourself. It really couldn't be more pleasurable sitting and knowing that you love a book and that you're going to spend that much time thinking about it and recreating it. But having said that, it is also lovely, the surprise of occasionally being offered something or being sent something that you really hadn't read before, and that happened with Hurricane Season. That was by Fernanda Melchor, and then I really dug my heels in and really wanted to translate it. So I did the most that I could, which was the best sample that I could, to try and convince them to allow me to do it. But I also must say that, you know, like, the more visibility the translators get, the more I often worry as well, that people often say that they love my last book, or not me, but, you know, they love the translator's last translation, so they'll read anything that translator translates. And I think, oh God, don't do that. I also have to earn a living. I don't always choose the books. They can be, I'll try not to translate anything that I don't think is worth being translated personally, and I'll let the gods decide on, you know, whether it should be elsewhere. But I have also translated books that are not, you know, that don't really resonate, to go back to resonance, that don't necessarily mm-hmm. resonate deeply with me.
Thank you very much. Jen, does that echo with your experience?
It's slightly different, I think, in that the majority of the books I've done, I would say, were commissions, either through, initially doing reader reports, which is a common practice for translators, whereby publishers whose editors don't necessarily speak foreign languages commission you to read books in the language or languages that you can read, and then you write them a small report, basically telling them what the book is about the author, how successful the book was in the original context, and often, which is the hard bit, giving your opinion on what you think about the book. So quite a few of the books that I've done have been through reader reports, whereby I had written maybe a very positive review, a report about the book, and then been commissioned to do a translation extract or sample, and then been commissioned to do the full book, which is always really amazing. But I think what came to mind, mostly because I've done some pitching but never really had much success, it can be a very long term, labour intensive job, pitching books you really love, because there's so many factors involved. You know, you have to convince a publisher. Someone else might really want to translate that book. It can be very, very tricky. But there have been at least two instances where I've really loved a book, and I've heard that the rights have been sold to a publisher, and then I've immediately gone, not begging, but I've gone to that publisher and been like, I'm the one that needs to translate this book, and really like made a case for why it should be me. And in the one case, I already had an extracted translation done already, and I was like, look, here's the proof, here's this translation extract, and that they gave me the job, which was to translate My Father Was a Man on Land and a Whale in the Water by the Swiss author Michelle Steinbeck. And the other case is a book I'm translating at the moment, called The Liquid Land by the Austrian author Raffaella Edelbauer. And I'd heard this book was amazing, a friend of mine had recommended it, I read it, and I was like, I have to translate this book. And in that case, I contacted the editor at Scribe, and they said that actually I was already on their radar, so that was quite nice. But then I had to do a competitive sample, which meant that I was commissioned to do a sample alongside, I think, four or five other translators. And then the publisher chose my sample, and then I got the ultimate commission. Sometimes it feels like you're on an adventure and you're kind of chasing after these books, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think those are the most common ways. And then based on recommendation, I think if you're lucky, once you've done a few books and, editors start recommending you, then that can also lead to commissions.
Well, no, I mean, thank you both. It sounds incredibly intense. I mean, once, you know, kind of reminded of architectural, competitions for commission, where, you know, you have to come up with a proposal for the building, of course, at your own expense, and then you might or might not get taken forward. Or actors hearing about, you know, a script that's hot, that's doing the rounds and desperately wanting, you know, whichever leading part it might be. I mean, it's obviously a very intense industry to be part of, and partly, I guess, in terms of English, because, of course, relatively speaking, so few books come into English compared to the volume across many languages that are published. And so we are in a sort of golden age, given that it feels at the moment. And it's interesting to see the publishers that you're working with, both of you, Fitzcarraldo, Serpent's Tale, Pirini, Charco, One World, and so on. All of these are predominantly independent publishers, exciting, engaged, often small presses who are committing themselves to work in translation, which is obviously a great thing for us as readers. But I wonder, on top of that, with the challenges they face, if they are smaller, of course, in keeping themselves going, is the idea of women in translation. I'm certainly very aware of women as translators in terms of the kind of books I read from these kinds of presses. But do you feel yourself, both of you, to be part of communities, a community of women who are translators, or is gender not quite as sort of front-loaded as we might feel it is or should be?
Yeah, it's a tricky one, because I mean, on the front of the independent publishers, I think, from my perspective, and I think many translators' perspectives, their enthusiasm and they make translation seem the norm. And, you know, like talking to editors from those publishers, it's like you don't even have to have that conversation around why you should be publishing a translation, if you get what I mean. So it's, you know, that's so appealing, and you end up forming very strong bonds with those editors and those publishers, because there's that level of understanding that it's not going to be a hard sell on top of having to, you know, talk about possible books. In terms of women in translation, obviously the conversation focuses a lot more on, you know, that there's a real imbalance in terms of men and women coming into English in translation. When it comes to being a woman translator and communities, I mean, I'm currently writing a PhD, like a creative critical PhD, so I'm looking at creative nonfiction written by women and non-binary translators about the art of translation. And the reason why I pitched that project, not pitched, but, you know, applied to do that PhD, was because I felt that a number of women and non-binary translators were writing the most interesting work about the art of translation. And I felt like these were writers, translators as writers, like Emma Ramadan and Lara Veneau, and even Sophie, you know, Sophie, the way Sophie writes and talks about translation, I felt a real kinship, because it was very much looking at, and Kate Briggs, actually, that I mentioned in the piece, talking about how being a woman might in some way affect your, not only the way you translate in terms of your experiences, in terms of gendered experience, but how it also affects your actual day-to-day life as a translator. So looking at, experiences translating authors that are the same gender as you or not so, or, things such as pay and having discussions around those things. You know, I'm thinking back to a conversation, you know, when me and Sophie were at our friend Ruth's house, who's a translator, with another translator, Rosalind, and we were just talking about the kind of back end of translation in the industry and how nice it is to like have very close friends that you can talk about your experiences with. I think that's what it makes me think of. But what about you, Sophie?
I think the first thing I would say is that I think in the UK we are extremely lucky in a way, because we have been so slow and awful at getting literature from around the world and from the world's wealth of languages and cultures into English, because we are so horrifically bad at that. In a way, the kind of groundswell now and the state where we are now, which is perhaps what you were referring to a little bit when you mentioned the word activism before, before Gareth, but that sense that now we've got to sort of make amends for our sakes as much as anything, because otherwise our culture will remain as poor, you know, as it naturally and obviously is if we don't translate. So I think that has created a really unique community of translators. I don't mean just among women, actually. I just mean generally among within our profession. I think in the States there is one too, from what I can sense. I'm sort of on the border of it, obviously as an English language translator, but I don't live there. But the sense that we in the UK, not just thanks to kind of bigger bodies like the Society of Authors who have the Translators Association, but also just get-togethers, like it can be a lunch at, you know, someone's house, or it can be supporting other translators when an author is coming from across the world to do a reading somewhere. And these communities aren't just in London. They're in Edinburgh. You mentioned Charcot before. They're in Manchester. They're in Sheffield. They're in Norwich, very much so. They're all over the country. These pockets of people who care so much about our culture, but right down to the caring about where a comma goes in a sentence. And I don't know that there's another job I could have found in the world where we still cared that much about those small things and thought and cared because we understood them to be significant. And I feel so deeply lucky that I get to not just sit down and translate every day, but be part of the British literary translation scene.
Well, that's tremendous. I mean, thank you both. And it's great to hear that, you know, first of all, the care and commitment you both bring to it, but also, of course, how much you feel it matters, and that there is a community, however defined, of interest around it. You've both been part in the last few days of Europa 28, which is a pan-European project focused around and by women on the future of Europe. And I just wonder if you could each give us a sense of how productive you found that, and whether that also has kind of sort of feeds into and speaks to some of the concerns you've raised so far.
Well, this is a project that I was invited to, not to sort of edit the whole project, but the anthology, the accompanying anthology that was published by Comma Press in the UK and also in Croatian and in Spanish. And essentially it's 28 women. They're not all writers. We've got scientists, journalists, people working in the charity sector, people working in the tech, absolutely extraordinary women who are in some ways, the project believes, working towards a different European future. And so what we wanted to do with the anthology was bring them together and ask them to write short pieces about their visions for the future of Europe. And what emerged was a really extraordinary conversation between these women who didn't speak at all and obviously have not been able to because of COVID. But it reads as these texts kind of echo across each other, even though they are writing, some of them are writing fiction, some are writing non-fiction, but not just that, you know, writing from across this vast continent, from their different perspectives. But what became really clear is that all of them in some way showed in their writing that more than anything they were trying to listen to it was a kind of writing process of listening and stopping and thinking about the other, thinking about how the future, what we can't quite grasp. And it was strange working on it, because as I did, I remember thinking, oh, is this going to work? Is this just going to be a complete hodgepodge? We got these essays coming in and I was like, oh no, I'm not sure any of this goes together. And then suddenly it was like magic. This sort of thread started running through them. And I was like, this is exactly it. This is not a book of reason and opinion. This is a book of hope and imagination, as well as expertise, as well as knowledge and experience. And Jen was one of about 15 translators, because many of the women, many of the 28 unbelievably, so many were able to write in English themselves. But Jen was invited to translate one of the pieces.
Thank you very much. I mean, for those of you who don't know Europa 28, of course, you can buy the anthology from all the usual places. You can actually watch the event series that unfolded literally just this week on the Hay Festival website under the Monica Europa 28. Now, just before we move sadly to a close, we could clearly talk for considerably longer on translation, the nature, the need for it, and its ongoing resonance in the world. But before we close, Jen, perhaps I could just ask you, as a writer independently of translation, how you think about what you bring to the act of translating has or has not informed your own creative writing. Do you find that they are completely different disciplines, or are they constantly cross-fertilising?
Again, there's probably this myth that in order to be a literary translator, somehow you have to be a creative writer in your own right, which I think is quite unfortunate, because I think it comes about because there's a tendency for writer translators to end up getting more attention than literary translators who don't write their own mm-hmm. work. So there's been a number of statements which are very irritating around, you know, like, oh, maybe literary translators should work with real writers in order to create really good translations, etc., which is really harmful, I think, to the way that we view literary translators, who are ultimately incredible writers in their own right, that just happen to be, you know, rewriting other people's books. So first, I think that's an important point to make. But I think I became a translator because I was a writer first. I started writing when I was in my teens, and then I taught myself advanced German by reading German novels. So my only skill as a translator is I can only translate literature. And I think that was just my way in. For other people, it's being a linguist first and then training to become a stronger creative writer. So I think that's just the series of events that happened that made me end up being a literary translator. Translation, I think, has really influenced the way I write now. I think the same way that when I do a first draft of a translation, my first drafts are full of kind of dot, dot, dot holes where I need to look something up, or mm-hmm. multiple words split up by forward slashes. And yesterday I was doing some writing, and I've started doing exactly the same thing when I write in English, because it feels like a really natural way now of building up a text, mm-hmm. To not try and write the perfect sentence or the end sentence right from the beginning, and to take time in the building of it. Mm-hmm. So I think it's becoming more and more an influence in my process of writing. And it also sneaks into the things I write about in terms of my own fiction and poetry. I can't help but be obsessed by translation. I think about constantly and think about how we communicate with others, not only across languages and cultures, but just with each other within the same language and culture, and how to make ourselves vulnerable and accessible to other people in our thinking. So, yeah, it has a huge influence on my writing.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for such wonderful thoughts, experiences and insights, and for sharing them with us. I mean, that's a great kind of call to action, I think, from both of you in all your distinctive ways. It feels timely that we're recording this conversation on the 9th of October, because right now, underway, about halfway through, is a 12-hour reading of Emily Wilson's translation of Homer's The Odyssey online between the London Review Bookshop and the German Street Theatre in London. They have 72 actors reading the entire translation over 12 hours, and Emily Wilson, of course, is also a Booker Prize judge for 2020. So it feels like, all in all, a pretty strong moment for women in translation, and delighted that we can mark your own significant contributions to that tradition today with the Whopping Project podcast. Thank you very much indeed, Sophie Hughes and Jen Galecka, for being with us. And I do hope listeners out there that you'll be excited and energised and inspired to track down Jen and Sophie's work in all the usual ways that you know how, and with all the further information you need available online. Thanks very much indeed to both of you for being with us, and of course to the Whopping Project for making all of this possible.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many thanks indeed, Sophie and Jen. And I'm delighted next week to be in conversation with the writer of the story that Sophie translated, Alia Trabuco-Zaran, the Chilean writer of The Last Word. I'll be in conversation with her, and we'll hear a reading of the story by the actor Polly Kemp. I do hope you can join me. Thank you very much indeed for listening.